Thank you, Ken. We are reading, I have been reading from Experience Your Perfect Soul, which is a joyful path to self-realization. And I've been sharing from Catherine Piedrick, and the quotes by Catherine Piedrick are from the book The Practical Mystic, How to Make Perfection Appear. And this is chapter four. From Experience Your Perfect Soul. And we are starting at the top of page 124 for anyone who likes to follow along with the book. This particular section we've been reading from is called The Spiritual Idealist's Remedy for the Illusion Called Evil. And it's speaking, just in a brief summary, to a new understanding, the realization of truth, and how that can be, how that realization can be undertaken. And it talks about the idea of, sorrow and fear and evil and suffering and cruel taskmasters and inflicting pain where there's no refuge, no escape. Lots of blame, a sad world, misconceptions, constant searching. And some of that may feel familiar in our own lives. And we do this sort of searching to realize what the truth is. At the same time, it says there is a different way that we can also engage, which is much simpler, and it's simply the result of daily training. It says there's an antagonism that seems to go on between the mortal mind or the mortal sense and what it shows to us, which is, all of that sin, suffering, and sorrow, the feelings we experience as a result of that. That sense of, I have a free will, but this will is generally directed towards the baser aspects in the relative world we live in, and we seek in the wrong place for the very thing that we're trying to find relief from, which is all the sin, sorrow, suffering, death, on and on and on. And sometimes we feel like that's being forced upon us. So as we come to recognize or catch a glimpse that there's got to be a better way, and we pursue that path. It says daily training, whether it be meditation, contemplation, reading, listening to audios, self-inquiry. There's, many, many ways in which this daily training can show up. And the revelations can be delivered through that process rather than this antagonistic way that the ego chooses. But it says the conflict between, the ego and the divine is inevitable. And it's not that the divine is in conflict, it's that the ego is in conflict, that there would even be a possibility other than itself to which you may turn as you come to realize, I am not these thoughts, I am not these feelings, I am not this person, I am not this body, I am not any of these material senses I've taken myself to be. And this spark of divine knowledge that is strengthening within myself in a clarifying sort of a way and a compelling sort of a way draws me more joyfully to this daily training. Something that I want to do. It's something that becomes the doorway to liberation. The intense desire for liberation is awakened. And this is just sharing with us, as that happens, there seems to be sometimes that antagonism that goes along with it. So, okay, we'll begin at the top of page 124. And it says the finite mental machinery is developed and trained each day by hours of study. And 1/2 hour is very little to give to the training of its opponent. Think of it. Think of that, what that just said. You know, if we're giving a half an hour a day to maybe meditation, for instance. And the rest of the time, the other 23 and a half hours, that energy is given over to what this is calling the training of the opponent, which is listening to the thoughts that appear in the mind, indulging the stories it creates, you know, exacerbating feelings that I might be experiencing and somehow claiming ownership of those as the individual persona I want to be. Yeah, that's the finite mental machinery that will not recognize the infinite simply through a half an hour of practice a day. And then we stoke the other side of that with 23 and a half hours of listening to the imposter, pretending to be myself. And what, I'm in the background agreeing to that? Really? Who is it that sees myself listening to those thoughts? Or, you know, stoking the fire under those feelings. Who is it that sees that? Who notices that? And as we decide to give more than 1/2 hour a day, as our practice time increases, we notice the strength of that background awareness. It is the strength. It is the only strength we have in truth. We notice that becoming more available, more in the foreground of our attention, more the reliance we look to when we notice the upsets, more the home in which we choose to continuously reside. And when we forget, we simply choose again. Goes on to say there are moments, even now, when our realization of the truth of true ideas is sufficient to wipe out entirely the material sense of things. And isn't that true? I mean, even in a meditation practice, for instance, when we have the instructions, if you notice thoughts, simply turn away from the thought. Don't finish the thought. You know, you cut it off. There's that dawning that, oh, there's a thought occurring. There's maybe even that the words in my, I notice the words in my mind. I'm not saying those are my thoughts anymore. I'm simply noticing there is a passing thought that's wanting to rev itself up in my mind. I notice that. And I'm the noticer, noticing the thought. But I'm the one that decides I'm not going to be involved. I simply notice that and let it go. Don't finish the thought. So, again, there are moments even now when our realization of the truth of true ideas is sufficient to wipe out entirely the material sense of things. Then not only do their appearances go, but their flashes into view a spiritual vision, what the Course would call Christ's vision. Not a vision that involves the body's eyes in the truest sense, although it may work through the body's eyes. It has nothing to do with the body's eyes. Christ's vision is that vision of innocence and purity, that sense of true knowledge that reflects the self that we all really are. So the appearance, what seems to be in front of the seeing eyeballs, that goes, that fades into a background, and into the foreground there springs the spiritual vision, a vision that's given. And it may just be a flash, what the Course calls a holy instant, where you actually have an experience, a feeling of the truth of the connection between you. And that would, of course, have nothing to do with the appearance. That's just the vehicle through which the flash seems to occur. So what we call lack of anything, failure of any kind, suffering and sin are but false conceptions and their appearances. Therefore, in a world containing so much sin and suffering of all kinds, it is natural that we should hear a good deal about coming into the truth, it being the only remedy for untruth and its appearances, or material phenomena. So, again, there's this, in a world where there's just so, we can look in our present day world right now, seeming to contain so much sin and suffering of all kinds. These are false conceptions. And as long as we have a false conception, which is a thought in the mind, and that thought in the mind will manufacture an appearance, what I think I see, and then what I see, I will experience, I'll have an experience of it in some way, shape, or form that's based on how I choose to think about it, a belief I hold. And that very belief will reinforce more thinking about what just was thought about and seen in the world. And so it's that closed loop that Regina talks about. But then it's natural within that closed parameter that we are exposed to other ideas, true ideas, pointers that point towards the truth. Or that coming into the truth, it's called here. And it's this coming into the truth, or this pointing in a different direction, is the remedy for untruth. It's the remedy for the appearances. It's the remedy for the material phenomena. But often we get caught up in those very appearances, or the phenomena of what is going on in the world. And we miss the pointers because we're so deeply, looking outward, mesmerized, by that, by the picture. We shall all have to come into, that is, come to understand and realize the truth fully, sooner or later. The way of our coming may be hard and terrible if we wait to be driven by suffering and sin to the taking of every new step. So again, the way of our coming to the truth may be hard and terrible. If we wait to be driven by suffering and sin to the taking of every new step. And, you know, even as I read that, it's like, and why would we wait for that? Why would we wait for that? Is there, you know, any good answer to that? When we're being told that simple practice can do the same thing right now. But instead, in the mind, you know, there's that notion of, I'll just wait for the other shoe to drop. Things are good right now, but you never know when the other shoe's gonna drop. Life is unpredictable. You know, do we allow ourselves to rest in that kind of thinking? Is there rest in that thinking? Do we ask that question in self-inquiry? Would a healed mind say that? Would a healed mind be driven by suffering and sin? By hardship? Terribleness? Would it? There's that section in A Course in Miracles that says that we are completely confused. And sometimes that takes the form of confusing pain as pleasure and pleasure as pain. Would a healed mind have that confusion? Wishing to know the truth for truth's sake will save us from its enforced discovery through suffering. Being good and loving, we shall realize the deficiencies of this human life, realize that it, at its best, is far from being wise, strong, beautiful, far from giving love to all and receiving love from all, far from being powerful over evil to any satisfying extent. The better and more loving we are, the keener will our realization be of the suffering about us. And such a realization will force us to reach out for that truth which, when we realize it as true, will save us and others from its shrinkages and limitations, its lack of joy and sympathy, its ignorance and wasted effort. And you know, I'm going to pause there for a moment because what came to mind, I saw a bit of a clip from a news anchor, an African-American fellow that I like a lot, actually. And he was commenting just from his own personal angst and sorrow over the latest tragedy in Las Vegas, the taking of so many lives, the wounding of so many people. And he was sharing how, from his perspective, it seems that the incidents are happening more and more and more often, and that there's almost a hardening of the impact. There's a numbing of these occurrences to the point where, it's big news for a couple of 3 days, and there's a lot of hoopla around it and trying to figure it out and looking at it, and then we, simply go on to the next thing, with very little resolution, very little change, very little, forward progress. And he was expressing his sadness over that there's such a such a lack of sympathy at a point. And on we go, as if things will improve of themselves without having to change our minds, see things differently. But this again, the better and more loving we are, the keener will our realization be of the suffering about us. And such a realization will force us to reach out for that truth, which, when we realize it as true, that will give us the power over the evil of the world. That truth will save us. That truth will save others from the shrinkages and limitations of the evil of the world and the lack of joy of that world, the lack of sympathy of that world, the lack of ignorance of that world, and the lack of wasted effort in that world. And that world is in my own mind. Always. The external picture might be really loud. It is simply a reflection of an internal nature that needs to be looked at, and a confirmation of the truth of my real nature is where the safety lies. A confirmation of the truth of the nature of all of the characters on the screen of the world. The affirmation of that within my own mind is what needs to be happening. And that's why it starts off by saying the better and more loving we are. That's the practical application right now. As simple as that. More loving. Giving love, receiving love. Same thing. Hence, at the outset, our purpose is to search constantly for more truth, and not merely because the knowing of the truth is the only thing which makes the good appear. The spiritual nature in us has been speaking, but we have not known it to be ourselves. It has spoken, and we have heard. But it did not seem like our hearts speaking, and we have not listened seriously to its messages. This coming to know ourselves, to know what we really are and what we really know, this is what is happening and what must happen to each of us. This state of mind into which we have now entered appears to us as a spiritual activity, a truth-knowing activity. It has always been operating, has always been understanding more and more truths, has always been laying up treasures for us. But not until now have we consciously come to our own. When once any form of spiritual experience has revealed us to ourselves in this way, we can hardly be patient until we become more aware of the real nature and power of this truth-knowing activity, this sesame to untold treasures which has always been ours and of which we have made but unconscious use. I love that they use the word sesame because we generally associate that with open sesame. And to me, that's a reference to opening up my mind. And in the opening of the mind, the real nature of the mind, which is open, in which the treasures have been given as an inheritance. They've never not been there. It's always been mine, given in my creation. The process of creation is the treasure itself. And I can be unconscious of that with external focus, looking outside. That's the training of the world. And now we're asked to have all that training simply dissolve. That's what the miracle is. There doesn't have to be an understanding, an intellectual understanding on my part about how that can happen, because I have no clue. I don't know this thing I am, nor what I'm doing, where I am, or how to look upon the world or on myself. I couldn't possibly know that while the mind is split. And it's only in the willingness to have the split healed that the conscious knowing presents itself into this unconscious state, which is, you know, ego, focus on the ego, focus on this imposter self that doesn't even exist in truth. It is the unconsciousness. It is giving that power of attention to a false God, this made-up me that doesn't really even exist. And in the opening, the decision to turn around and look in the other direction, inward, not outward, that the treasures are discovered. And consciousness can be used divinely. Life has a new meaning, and the spirit of adventure and discovery seizes upon us. The spiritual realm has always been open, and we're destined to go in and take possession of it throughout eternity by means of a truth-knowing capacity which is inalienably ours. Inalienably. It's not alien to us. It's our true nature. It's our self. It is consciousness itself, awareness itself, aware only of awareness and nothing else. And now we know that just in proportion as we knock, shall it be opened unto us. And in proportion to our seeking, shall we find. And Hal this morning was talking about, what is it we value? What is it we invest in? What is it we do with our time? Michael Langford, Elie Ruzdahr, both ask, how much time are you engaged in distractions? Activities that lead away from what we say we want to know, to be. I really want to know who I am in truth. I just want to know the truth. And then look at your day, look at your activities, look what you think, what kinds of, mental gymnastics you become involved in, what kind of words come out of your mouth, how you treat the people in your family, how you treat strangers, what kind of upsets you experience, how much weight you give to that, how you decide to operate in the world, what kind of television you watch, what kind of activities you engage in, what kind of gossip you, all of those things. Look at what you do. That's what this is talking about. In proportion to how, how much, what door are we knocking on when we engage in those kinds of activities? What are we really seeking? I mean, we may say with our mouth that I want to only know truth, that I want to only know God, that I want to, only know the truth of myself. And then watch what you do and see if they match up. And if we complain, I've been on this path forever and ever and ever, and things haven't really changed all that much. That's because I haven't changed all that much. It's me every time. Period. Look within. Be honest. What is it I'm not giving? That's what's lacking in the situation. So again, the spiritual realm has always been open, and we're destined to go in and take possession of it throughout eternity by means of a truth-knowing capacity, which is inalienably ours. And now we know that just in proportion as we knock, shall it be opened unto us. And in proportion to our seeking, shall we find. Our delight is not for a moment checked. Although we realize that in order to make this vision last and come to fulfillment, much real work must be done. We must have a period each day when we do concentrated work upon spiritual conceptions, new as well as old. For all conceptions of reality, insofar as they are spiritual, contain that truth, the knowing of which gives us power over evil. And that was the end of that particular section. So, yeah. The next section talks about the practical application of truth. So here we go. Page 128, Experience Your Perfect Soul. Every state of discord or disharmony which we experience gives proof that we are not thinking rightly about ourselves. The seeming wrong condition can only be changed by awakening to our spiritual origin and inheritance, our perfection in truth. And our false conceptions will then disappear. And this is simply restating what we just read. Every state of discord or disharmony. And as we know, from discord and disharmony comes sin, suffering, death, doom, disaster, all forms of hell. And those are simply proof that tries to reinforce the false self, made up self, the imposter self, the self that's screaming at you that this is you, when there's something within you that knows this is not who I am, this is not what I desire, this is not my purpose. This is not the truth of myself. And I can change this and return to my spiritual origin, which is my inheritance, by the way, which is my perfection, by the way, which is my truth, by the way. And when I rest there by giving it my attention, that's how I rest there. By turning my attention away from the discord, away from the harmony, away from these experiences that seem to reinforce that, and I can simply notice that and ask, is this really what I want today, right now? Is this what I want? And we know it's not what we want because we feel rotten with these experiences. And when we turn and take our attention off of that and focus it inward, curious, asking, praying, Father, show me myself. I do not know the thing I am. And I wait silently, unexpectedly, happily to know something besides where my attention has mostly been driven through false conception. And that will dissipate as the strength of my truth, the strength of my perfection, the strength of myself becomes stronger. As a result of spiritual activity, in the conscious realization of the truth, one may gradually attain to a state of consciousness where his ideas may no longer be clothed in words, and spiritually poised on the height attained, he may seem to be immersed in a golden flood of light. I love that. His ideas may no longer be clothed in words. Any word. Remember, you know, Michael Langford says, thoughts are the words of your native language in your mind. And they come after. They're in addition to. They're fluff. They're ultimately meaningless. Your naked self, so to speak, your truth, has no words, is undescribable with words, is not couched in words. It's an add-on. It's the fluff. It's the foolery. So this state of consciousness, this spiritually poised consciousness, this heightened attainment of consciousness can leave us immersed in a golden flood of light. To realize spiritual truth and attain to these uplifting spiritual experiences which follow, whatever they may be, is to be forever relieved of doubt as to the reality of spiritual substance. And certainly we've had enough people right here in this room share their experiences, even if they were temporary experiences. And I see that Mary is here, loved one, right here in the room with us. And I remember her sharing an experience a few retreats ago, a spontaneous experience that she had when she laid down to take a power nap and had a remarkable experience that was, as she conveyed it, again, her heart was touched with the joy of that experience, the revelation of that experience, the suspension of all doubt within that experience, the reality of that spiritual substance within that experience. And simply in the sharing of that experience, my heart, I mean, I want to cry even now, just thinking about her sharing that. It was so powerful. It didn't even have to be my direct experience. It is now. And that's why giving and receiving are the same in truth. And hopefully in the sharing of these experiences, it's not the glorification of the experience at all. There was no, the humbleness in the sharing of that experience was palpable. The entire room was touched, and we have that happen, you know, often in this room. And I totally appreciate when people are brave enough to, you know, share what might be perceived as, you know, something weird or, you know, whatever. I don't really, that's not how I feel. But in the sharing of it, it chips away at my own doubt. If I have not had these direct experiences as others have, to this extent, it relieves my own doubt. It fortifies my own spiritual substance. It's the same self. And this particular self just happens to be sharing in the moment. And it's a great gift when that happens. So this individual and conscious expression of truth is the duty of each one of us. Although these great words, spirit, love, truth, power, reflection, these chalices of life have been given to us, yet we cannot take the gift of such words lightly. Have we tried to reach down into the depths and up into the heights of consciousness, which the givers of words, always at the expense of ease, often at the expense of life, have reached? Again, the question is, have we tried to reach down into the depths and up into the heights? Often at the expense of life? I'm sorry. Let me try that again. Have we tried to reach down into the depths and up into the heights of consciousness which the givers of words have reached? Those that give the words, like when Mary was expressing herself, obviously she had reached a height that was totally unexpected. Totally unexpected. Yet it happened. And this is asking us, when these givers of words, like Mary was giving the words, trying to convey her experience, trying to convey a consciousness that might seem elevated from where we are, and even having some she had a bit of unease about it because there's words fail to really convey. And the emotion or the visceral feeling of the experience comes up. That can sometimes feel overwhelming as well. But this is asking us, have we tried to reach that depth or that height of consciousness? That sense of unease that I'm going beyond a space that I'm already comfortable with and kind of get, and it's not so bad. And so why should I leave the comfort of that space and go off beyond to some place that I have no idea what will come to me from there? How will that, what expense, what ex the expense of life, it says, what expense, how will, what will that cost me? We talked about that this morning. Reverend Hal talked about this morning. What's that going to cost me? How much am I willing to invest in this other capital L life that is already occurring that I seem to be unconscious of most of the time that is in fact something? There's a price to pay for it in pain and suffering. And I'm unwilling to dip my toe into this new depth or this new height because I might be uncomfortable. It might feel, I don't know, scary. And yet, when we hear like Mary's story, was that really scary? Didn't seem scary at all to me in her relaying of it. It sounded like the kind of experience everybody would desire. And that's what this is saying to us. That's what this eternal truth offers from the simple practice of reaching into the depths or reaching up to the heights, however you want to, frame that. to this state of consciousness that is you, as you are right now. Give it a try. The gift of a true living word lays upon us the burden of a quest. It is a cup, a grail, holy in content, consecrated to high uses. Acceptance of it upon our part signifies the taking of a vow to discover the eternal truth it symbolizes. Life or being is all there is in all existing things. What is life or being? Life or being is perfect consciousness. Being is spirit. Therefore, its consciousness is always true, always good, always beautiful, always perfect, always complete. All real men are through and through spiritual. They are experiencing true ideas, good and loving ideas, joy, power, and peace. That is, our experiences are confined to those which belong to life or being. Think how it feels to be conscious of good. Again, remind yourself that this spiritual state is also a life force, a substance force. Recall your state of mind when at some moment you knew a truth. That spiritual experience is also substantial and living. Joy and peace and all the fruits of the Spirit are spiritual experiences which are substantial and living. We have spiritual assurance that all being is of the nature of mind, spirit, that there is only this one source from which life can spring. We shall gain the spiritual apprehension of man, and so of our true selfhood, by the substitution of the activity of divine mind for all phenomena of sense experience. And I'm going to reread that again. We shall gain the spiritual apprehension of man, and so of our true selfhood, by the substitution of the activity of divine mind for all phenomena of sense experience. Spiritual apprehension of man. would a healed mind have apprehension? Spiritual apprehension of man. That does occur. I mean, obviously, if the mind is not completely healed, there can be apprehension in regards to spirituality. There can be apprehension in regards to what true selfhood really is. And this is saying to me that the only way that this sense experience, this phenomena that comes about as a result of this apprehension of the spiritual man or the true selfhood, the apprehension of the true selfhood, is to substitute the activity of divine mind, not activity of, you know, the material sense mind, the phenomena sense mind, the sense experience, the false mind, thinking. We substitute, when we notice that going on, we substitute the activity of divine mind. We stop and ask. We turn towards that divine mind and ask. What am I not seeing in this situation that you would have me see? What am I not hearing in this situation that you would have me hear? Teach me, Father, that I might know. Whatever you say to yourself that's appropriate when we have this, you know, phenomena of sense experience going on and we notice it actively pulling us away from divine mind. So, okay, here's the last paragraph, but we will not be finishing this particular section. When we say that the activities of spirit constitute all being, we make a definition of being which is all-inclusive. That the physical is left out in this definition of being is a little startling at first, but nevertheless, very much to be rejoiced over. Such a definition does not annihilate the physical order, but shows that it has always belonged to the realm of false sense and never to that of real being. And I'm going to stop there. That seems like a good place to stop, a simple place to stop. Again, the false sense, the physical order, is never, never the real being. Okay, so we are ending on page 131 in Experience Your Perfect Soul. I'll begin there next week. I thank you for joining with me. And I am going to be leaving the room, going to visit with my daughter for lunch. And so thank you for joining me. I appreciate it. And we'll listen on my phone in the car. Thanks, guys. Have a great day.